Welcome back to Word and Table, a bi-weekly podcast on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship and why it is vital in our world today. I'm your host, Alex Wilgus, and I'm here again with Father Stephen Gauthier. Welcome back, Father Stephen.
Hi, Alex. Great to be back.
Father Stephen is the canon theologian of the Diocese of the Upper Midwest and the Anglican Church in North America, and he is director of formation at St. Paul's House of Formation in the Greenhouse Movement. Father Stephen, this week I suggested that we do another episode on one of our church fathers, this one, John Chrysostom, really cool name. But I suggested him because I've actually been reading a lot of his sermons, and before I was ordained to the priesthood, I read On the Priesthood. But I got to say, I really, really like his sermons a lot. And I'm preparing a wedding homily right now. And I always look up his sermon on marriage because I think it's just so great. I think it could be preached today. I wanted to just maybe you could give us an intro about who he is. Tell us about his early life, his career, and then what he's left us.
Sure. First of all, his name's interesting. Chrysostom means something. It wasn't his real name. You know, we used to, in English, talk about people having a silver tongue. And it's like calling him John the Silver-Tongued. In Greek, it means literally golden-mouthed.
Oh, I see. Okay.
That doesn't sound so great in English, but it means, boy, he was a great speaker.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is important because in the ancient world, the highest form of artistic achievement was public speaking. And so in the Greek world, the best of the pagan Greek speakers was Demosthenes. He's the classic orator. You'd study his orations. And he was called the Christian Demosthenes.
Yeah.
He was really a great orator. People loved him. Matter of fact, that's why he ended up, we'll talk about his career, ended up as Patriarch of Constantinople, which is the lead Greek-speaking church.
Uh-huh.
Because he was such a good speaker, people wanted him. He was very important. You know, we talked about the doctors of the church, the great teachers of the church. There were four great Latin doctors and four great Eastern doctors. He's one of them, along with Athanasius, Basil the Great of Caesarea, and
Gregory the Great,
Gregory of Nazianzus.
Gregory of Nazianzus, that's right.
Gregory the Great's all on the Latin side.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And he's also one of the three ecumenical doctors, meaning universal, and saying, you know, these are the real guys that for your go-to guys with Basil and with Gregory Nazianzus again.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like I hear his name cited quite a bit more than a lot of others.
Yeah, he and Augustine are probably the two most popular fathers of the church, the most widely read. When you look at collections, like the traditional collections, there are far more of their works that have survived than any of the other fathers, vastly more.
Yeah.
There are volumes and volumes of Chrysostom and Augustine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about his early life. Where does he come from?
Well, he came from a family in Antioch, a Christian family. He was raised in a Christian family. A wealthy family, which is nice because allowed him to get a really top flight education.
Mm-hmm.
You can really tell.
Sure.
He's got a top flight education. His mother was a saint. I mean, she was later canonized as a saint. So he was raised in a very Christian way. He studied under the best rhetorician, you know, people who really taught you to be a great orator, was Libanius at Antioch. Now, Antioch was interesting because there are two great schools in the Eastern Church.
Mm-hmm.
Antioch was really one we would identify more with.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they basically studied the Bible in a very straight, what's its literal meaning, etc. Whereas the Alexandrian school was more into its allegorical meaning.
I see. Kind of the spiritual
you know, allegories and spiritual, where they were much more, well, what does it actually say? You know,
yeah.
Much more into that. So he comes from that background. His early life, you know, he really got involved with prayer and study. He was the patriarch, Meletius of Antioch, took him under wing. And his widowed mother, he wanted to go off. You know, the monastic life was the big thing. There was a real monastic movement going on. He really, wanted that a lot.
Yeah, he shares that with the other Eastern guys as well, right?
Right. There's a classic thing. To this day, we have a tradition in the Eastern Church that your monastics become bishops.
I see. Yeah.
They normally choose bishops from monastics. It's sort of like the grad school. Sort of like if you're an accountant, you normally do a few years of auditing. It's sort of your grad school and then go off into industry.
Yeah. 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 It seems, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, Father Stephen, but it sort of feels the emphasis on the monastic or the ascetic life at that time feels a little bit to me like the modern evangelical emphasis on missions. you know, that like we have our church, but then there's also this life out there that we live, like how the church kind of enters the world.
Well, actually, they came to a crisis about this time, because during the heroic age of the church with the persecutions and the like,
mm-hmm.
the church had plenty of, you know, it's a heroic age. You
yeah.
know, spreading the faith and standing up for the faith and persecution and things gave a real sense of purpose
yeah.
and victory. Ironically, the church sort of felt itself had become flabby with becoming the church of the empire.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real sense that this isn't the glory days anymore. You know, a lot of regular people who don't have that much, that the church had lost its edge. And that was the opening. We'll talk about it in another episode, I'm sure, about monasticism.
Yeah.
Is people trying to recapture the edge, getting radical, you know, recovering the church's radical gospel roots.
Right.
And so that was, he's really fresh when this is happening. So what, the only thing that stopped is his mother is widowed, and she said, look, I need you around.
Yeah, yeah.
And so for that reason, he doesn't go away right away. He's selected as bishop, but he's not there in another, he's somewhere else, not in Antioch, but he runs away, and that's where he writes the book on the priesthood to justify why he ran away.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
By the way, this is a constant trope in the ancient church.
I was about to say, I feel like I've heard a few other of these narratives, like, oh, I was selected for spiritual office, but I didn't feel worthy, so I ran away.
Right. If yeah. you're really worthy, you feel unworthy.
But so, right, right, right. So it's kind of like a
if you want the office, you're unworthy.
Okay, yeah. So it's kind of a backhanded ratification of why he's right for this. Yeah.
Right. But it also allows him to do what he really wanted to do. He runs away for 6 years. And he never does anything by half. I mean, one thing you like about John Chrysostom, he really follows things through. But in this case, sadly, he was so big on the asceticism, the personal denial, the fasting, and all the things they do, staying out in the cold and the like, mm-hmm. that it seriously hurt his health.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he never really fully recovers, but he comes back to Antioch. And then there he gets ordained as a deacon and then a priest. What's really interesting there is he becomes the chief preacher of the city. He is such a great orator. This is unusual. Normally, the bishop is the chief, you know, but you know, he was brought in. People loved him for 12 years. And everybody throughout the Greek East is talking about this guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Everyone's talking about it. So that's why people in Constantinople, which is the capital city, you know, they say, we got to get this guy. So he's actually forced to go to Constantinople. He is sort of one of those invitations that you take. He goes to that and becomes yeah. the patriarch, which is, you know, the bishop of Constantinople. Now, he ends up with three opponents here. First of all, Theophilus of Alexandria wanted.
He wanted the bishopric.
He wanted that. He was put aside for John Chrysostom.
So John Chrysostom starts to get enemies when he ascends to high office, as one does.
the failed rivals. That's if you get the job and somebody doesn't. The person uh-huh. didn't get the job did not go gently into that good night.
I see. Okay.
Theophilus is tireless in causing him problems.
Okay.
You know, because he really wants the job.
Okay.
Another thing is Eutropius. Eutropius was actually a eunuch, but what happens is Arcadius is the emperor. The Arcadius mm-hmm. is good for nothing. I mean, it's not his fault. He just ends up in the position.
Yeah.
But he doesn't want it. And so what happens, I mean, he doesn't really know what to do. And so there needs to be a power to really run things. So Eutropius, the eunuch, is the power behind the throne. And his real power came as he had arranged the marriage with an extraordinarily controlling person named Eudoxia.
Mm-hmm.
She's actually Frankish. She was the daughter of the Frankish consul.
Yeah.
So it brought, you know, political connections. So he arranged the marriage, which was his key to power. Matter of fact, something had never happened before. He was a eunuch. He was actually made a consul.
Oh, really?
A eunuch made a consul. This really offended a lot of people, but he was. But in any event, what'll happen is he falls from grace, okay? He's eliminated by, Eudoxia herself becomes a new power behind her husband. You know, she could get rid of him. So she gets rid of Eutropius.
The wife of the emperor. Yeah. So now she's the one calling the shots.
Yeah. He had gotten her into place, but now she's in place. She doesn't need him anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So off he goes. And now she takes over.
Yeah. Yeah.
So some of the struggles with Eudoxia fun is that, you know, she was really into luxury and things.
Yeah.
And John Chrysostom really believed in social justice, and he believed that Christians ought to live a life that isn't materialistic and like, and he preached on topics like this.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, so she didn't take that kindly.
Well,
yeah.
We think it was innocent, but you know, she took it as directly aimed at her.
Yeah, yeah.
She was sort of the poster child for material. Okay. She was the material girl of that century.
I got it. So she's maybe the Kardashian of her time.
Yes. So she gets together with Theophilus of Alexandria and said, can't you get this guy out of here? So he's accused of heresy.
Oh, I see.
Theophilus is his old friend who, you know, the guy who's passed over for the job.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So Theophilus actually reigns the Synod of the Oak, which is like a lynch mob.
Oh, okay.
Which officially gets him condemned, a charge of treason. He's condemned to exile. And they send him off.
Yeah.
But then something happens that's funny. Eudoxia is superstitious. And so what happens is, shortly after he leaves, there's a big earthquake, which she thinks might be because of how she treated him. So he's called back.
Okay, okay.
But that doesn't last for long. Mm-hmm. Eudoxia is Eudoxia.
Yeah.
And so what happens here is she has a statue erected to herself. And during the dedication, which is during a Sunday, in front of the church, in front of a Sunday service, there's so much noise that John Chrysostom was, can you keep it down?
I'm sure that went over well.
You can only imagine how that went over. So again, Theophilus is always ready to help out when Eudoxia needs help against John Chrysostom. He's just tireless in his jealousy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this time they accuse him of being not following canon law and how he was reinstalled.
Okay.
And so he's deposed of his priestly functions. He's actually arrested during the Easter Vigil.
Holy cow, really? Yeah.
And in exile, he's sent off to Armenia. That seems far enough away. But he still stays in real contact with people. Mm-hmm. He's writing some beautiful letters he writes to both to Antioch and to Constantinople, his friends back there. And so they figure, basically, this is really sad because what happens is they really want to get rid of him. So they officially are moving him to the far east side of the Black Sea.
I see.
But the real message is make sure something happens on the way.
Really? Okay.
He's an old man, so they didn't have to. Well, basically, it's just
so they gave him
walk
a,
him to death,
a rough basically. Ride.
Yeah, make it really tough. So he died of natural causes on the way.
Oh man, oh, that's so sad.
It's very sad.
Yeah,
but then Eudoxia is dead, so they actually bring his remains in triumph back to Constantinople.
Really, really.
So that's sort of his story.
Wow, 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 man, that's a really kind of. I mean. It's really sad, but it seems like almost God arranges his story to live out his faith in this way, you know, being persecuted.
Well, I think it gives a real credibility to him because the fact is, first of all, he was no man pleaser.
That's for sure.
He wasn't trying. And there was an easy way. A lot of people would have taken this as a great place, you know, of power and prestige and comfort.
Mm-hmm,
he
mm-hmm.
really lived an ascetical life.
Yeah, yeah.
The monk never left him. The fact that he was in this incredible position, he still lived like a monk.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was sort of a living witness against people who lived differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really powerful. Well, let's talk about what he leaves us. So you said that he wrote quite a bit. And not only that, but we still have quite a bit of what he wrote.
That's important because people kept reading it.
Okay.
People thought, you know, one of the reasons why things survive is because it's also like when you study patristics, you'll wonder why are some texts hard to get a whole copy of hold of? And then when you get a copy, you realize why. is the really good stuff tends to survive.
Okay. I see. So
there are many exceptions, but I mean, they're really good stuff. And he was so popular that mm-hmm. his stuff was just not lost. I mean, some was lost, but he was an incredible writer, but a vast amount of what he wrote has survived.
So the very reason that I find his homily on marriage, for instance, useful for preparing my homily is probably the reason we still have it. Yeah. That's great.
Or like, and as far as his, actually it's the sermon on statues when he was back in Antioch, which is, if you like Greek, is that was his most famous rhetorical work.
Mm-hmm.
It's really brilliant. What happened is there was a tax riot in Antioch, and as part of the riot, people tore down statues of the emperor's family, which is high treason. And, so he basically writes these sermons of defense of the people, you know, asking for mercy and things from the emperor.
Yeah.
But they're monuments to Greek style.
Yeah.
So people are really into Greek. The quotes, the sermons on the statues,
the
speech on the statues are probably in some ways his best work in mm-hmm. Greek, as far mm-hmm. as the language.
Wow. Okay.
The ancients really liked.
So that's his best like rhetorical.
Probably his best rhetorical.
Okay. Yeah. Got it.
But one of the things people like too, he speaks of the 20th century. he's very much in justice saying, you guys are, everybody's willing to give gold candlesticks and things to the church.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're traditionally beggars hung outside of churches.
Uh-huh.
And he said, you're bringing golden, you know, draperies and things to put up in the church, and you're passing Christ is there in rags.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, believe me, Christ would rather be clothed.
Yeah.
So he emphasized that the first place to honor God is to, you know, is to honor him in the poor rather than in his churches.
Yeah.
He said, it's nice to do those things, but not as a substitute. He said, you know, you should be ashamed, basically. You're actually bringing this big gold gift or something into the church, some new candlestick or something,
sure,
when you're tripping over Christ.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, who's desperately cold and hungry.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's so important. Well, hopefully that speaks to the 21st century.
And he lived
well.
That life.
Yeah.
He wrote some ascetical treatises, defended the monastic life, and some letters. And his most famous thing is the homilies on the Psalms. They're very, very good. Homilies on Matthew and John. Homilies on Romans. As you mentioned, on the priesthood. On the priesthood is a harder read. You know, on marriage is...
yeah, I've noticed that. My sense is that his rhetorical style and the way he... the direction he takes through an argument doesn't translate super well into English. It feels a little winding.
You know what I think to a modern reader, see if you agree with this. I know you've heard a lot of Chrysostom. My impression is always, it's like going through a forest and you get these beautiful clearings.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And
that
then
is,
you say, this is amazing. And then you're back in the woods.
And then you get back into the little rhetorical labyrinth. Yeah.
Which people really admire. They really love these turns of phrase and things.
Yeah, probably sounds better in Greek.
Yeah, and then he wrote on the education of children, one of our early pedagogical treatises.
Oh,
so
okay.
A lot of people like that. How do you educate your children?
Oh wow, I haven't read that one. That's becoming very relevant to me these days. So.
Yes,
that's great. Well, anything else you'd have for us on John Chrysostom, Father Stephen?
I would just encourage people again. Some of these, there are some books that you say I ought to read, and others that not only I ought to read them, I'm really going to like them.
Yeah.
John Chrysostom is someone you're really going to like.
Okay, so still reads well today. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
And Augustine will meet that same test. Things like the Confessions in the City of God, when we talk about Augustine, are really good reads. To this day, people read them with great profit.
Well, thanks so much, Father Stephen. That's all the time we have left for this episode. And thank you for listening to Word and Table. We'll be back again in a couple of weeks for more on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship. Thanks for listening.